You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The corporate world is like the ocean. It's alluring, but it's also full of deadly creatures that can shred you to pieces.
It becomes kind of like a Game of Thrones political arena where everyone's trying to murder you to get your job.
My family doesn't come from corporate background, so I didn't have any sort of guidance in that.
This is not your typical work podcast.
Sometimes you need to be empathetic. And then there are times that you ask for input, but you don't really give a shit.
Listen to the Ambie Award-nominated podcast, Surfing Corporate.
Stretch opportunity. What is this, yoga class? Get out of here.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. The future is coming. Make it brighter with Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a unique website. Showcase your work, blog, or publish content, even sell products and services of all kinds in just a few clicks. You can customize everything from look and feel to settings and products using beautiful templates created by world-class designers. And there's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code KICK to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, that's squarespace.com and offer code KICK. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. North Korea, Syria, Afghanistan, Venezuela. Those are just a few of the countries that have received the dubious honor of making it onto the International Crisis Group's annual list of 10 conflicts to watch in 2018. The International Crisis Group was founded in 1995 by a group of prominent statesmen who despaired at the international community's failure to anticipate and respond effectively to the tragedies of Somalia, Rwanda, and Bosnia. ICG serves as the world's eyes and ears for impending conflicts and advocates for effective action from global policymakers. Today I'm joined by the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, Robert Malley, who will discuss the 10 conflicts to watch list, the areas that made it on his list, and some that didn't. He reveals how his home life growing up destined him for a career in conflict resolution and taught him from an early age the importance of seeking to understand your enemies. He talks about the value of having boots on the ground in some of the world's most dangerous places and how the International Crisis Group operates differently from traditional think tanks. He looks back at his own role in the Camp David summit and the Iran nuclear deal, cautions against Donald Trump's bluster about decertifying the Iran deal, and suggests that the vacuum Trump leaves on the world stage could present an opportunity for Europe to step forward. He says the stakes in North Korea are too high to be ignored. He warns that Afghanistan is once again becoming a problem area and speculates on what will happen in Syria once ISIS has been defeated militarily. Plus, he shares why he thinks a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is unlikely to happen. He talks about the crises that aren't getting enough attention in the media and some that made it off the list in 2018. Coming up with the International Crisis Group's Robert Malley in just a moment. Robert Malley is president and CEO of the International Crisis Group. Prior to that, he served in the Obama administration as special assistant to the president, senior advisor to the president for the counter-ISIL campaign, and White House coordinator for the Middle East, North Africa, and the Gulf region. He also served as special assistant to President Clinton for Arab-Israeli affairs and director for the Near East and South Asian affairs at the National Security Council. The International Crisis Group recently released its annual list of the 10 global conflicts to watch in 2018, and we'll talk about that and more today. Robert Malley, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
For those who don't know about your organization, briefly just tell us, what does the International Crisis Group do?
So we have one mission, which is to do what we can to resolve, prevent, and mitigate the impact of deadly conflict around the world. And the way we do that, unlike some other organization, is that we have people in the field. So we have people living who either live in or travel to Yemen or to Afghanistan or to Venezuela or to Ukraine, wherever deadly conflict either rages or we fear is about to rage. And so we have those people embedded in those countries who get to really understand the country, speak to everyone, all sides, rebels, insurgents, government officials, ordinary citizens. And then we write up what we find and we recommend and advocate on behalf of policies that we believe could prevent, mitigate, or resolve deadly conflict. And our audience is ordinary citizens, involved citizens, but also governments around the world, international institutions. And so we are an activist organization that tries to get people to do something about the suffering of civilians.
Yeah, you definitely seem to be more proactive than probably what people usually think of as a think tank.
Because we try. You have to give us a penny every time you call us a think tank.
Well, I was just going to say, do you chafe at that term, think tank?
Yeah. We do, even though I've worked at think tanks. I have a lot of respect for them. But we are different because we have an institutional voice. I mean, most think tanks, it's a collection of very smart individuals who write and give their own opinion about certain issues. Two things distinguish us from traditional think tanks or from think tanks. One, again, we have people in the field, so they don't live in Washington or elsewhere. They live in the countries among the people who are fighting or who are suffering from the fighting. And we have a position, and we advocate on behalf of the position that we believe in.
What does that do for you, having actual boots on the ground?
It makes a huge difference. I've spent all together almost 10 years in government. And when you're in government, there's a lot you see that you don't see when you're on the outside, undoubtedly, and I think people know that very well. You also lose a lot. So it's both enriching and impoverishing, because when you're in government, you don't have time to walk around on the streets of Caracas or the streets of Kabul and talk to ordinary citizens. You also can't talk to people who are members of proscribed terrorist groups. So you can't talk to a member of Hamas or of Hezbollah or the Taliban. Members of Crisis Group, and I was there before joining the Obama administration. That's what we do. So we live there. We talk to people so that we could get the perspective of all sides. And, you know, it's a common place to say, you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. You also don't make peace if you don't understand your enemy. And that means we have to talk to everyone. And then when we meet with officials, whether they're American or Chinese or Russian or Syrian or whoever we meet with, we tell them, here's what we're hearing from the other side. You may not like it. You may not agree with it. I'm just telling you, this is what they're saying. This is what we think they're thinking.
In a certain sense, you're an intelligence gathering organization.
Let's avoid that term or we're going to be expelled from countries.
but you have the freedom to talk to all sides that someone who's working in government may not. So at the very least, if they can't have these conversations, you can. And then you can at least give them some kind of advice on where to go from there.
That's exactly right.
That's very interesting. Coming back to the crisis group, you just came back, I think, in the past couple of months. And having spent so much time in government, how has that experience shaped how you want the crisis group to work going forward?
But now that I'm back at crisis group, one of the lessons that I took from government is there's a certain way you speak to decision makers. You can't speak down to them and act as if they don't know what they're talking about. You can't give them 50 pages and expect they're going to read it. So we have to be more timely, more precise, more concise, and understand that if people whether it's a U.S. official or a Russian official, if they are pursuing a policy that we disagree with, it's not necessarily because they're stupid or they're blind or they don't know what they're talking about. It's because they have a different conception. Maybe there's aspects of the conflict they haven't thought about. And we need to be respectful of their view, but very sharp in when we disagree with them and try to come up with ideas that they could implement. So what I'm trying to bring to Crisis Group now is a sense of the realism and pragmatism that we need to have in our own findings, our own recommendations, so that a government official will take us seriously. The way I like to put it is our recommendations have to be out of the box, but not off the wall. They have to be something that people could read and say, oh, this challenges my conventional wisdom. But it's not so you know, outlandish that I'm just going to put it in a closet and never read it again.
Yeah, it must, I imagine, for you feel somewhat liberating to be out of the groupthink of government and be in a position where you're at least able again to consider all options and all opinions on the table now.
I mean, that's so true. You know, when you're in government, there always are differences of views. I mean, I came from an administration where, to take an example, Syria, there was a large divergence. But even that divergence is within boundaries, because there's some ideas that after a while, having been in government, you talk to the same people all the time. Mm-hmm. Some things simply become unthinkable. Now, you speak to people from the outside, as you just said, and that changes the parameters of your own thinking. So being outside of government now, it is liberating. I miss parts of it, I'll admit, but it is liberating because I'm able to not be as constrained by what we think we have to think or by what we think we cannot do.
And you founded the Middle East and North Africa program at Crisis Group, I think, about 16 years ago. You've since worked in other organizations and been back in government. Has your perspective on that specific region changed significantly in those years?
Well, the region has changed significantly.
Right.
So I guess by definition, my perspective has. I mean, let's not forget, back in the early 2000s when I started the program, the biggest complaint about the region was that it was too static. It was sclerotic. Nothing was ever going to change. The leaders were there forever. Gaddafi in Libya was there forever. Saddam Hussein in Iraq was there forever.
Now do you miss that?
And now, well, you know, some people miss it. I'm not sure about missing it. But it is our main concern when we wake up is what's going to be the new unrest, the new outbreak of violence. Let's just look at what happened in Syria in the space of about a week.
Yeah.
You've had fighting between Turkey and Kurds that involves allies of the United States, between Russia and the U.S., between Iran and Israel, between Hezbollah and Israel. I mean, this is really a region that is in chaos, and that presents a whole new set of challenges. We're no longer thinking, how are we going to shake things up, but how are we going to provide some sense of normalcy and stability for people who've suffered now, at least since 2011, one new development after another, and it's shaken up their lives. Mm-hmm.
I noticed that fairly recently you opened an office in D.C. or started doing advocacy.
We've started a U.S. program. So we've always had an Asia program, a Middle East program, Africa, in which we look at conflicts that affect those areas. We decided, and I think the decision was partly, I know it was partly triggered by the Trump administration and its foreign policies, but to be honest, we probably should have started this a long time ago. Mm-hmm. We're not looking at conflict within the United States, and hopefully we won't have to. But
yeah.
If it comes to that point, we will. But since we look at deadly conflict at a certain scale, that's not what we're looking at now. But we're trying to understand how U.S. foreign policy is made, what are the factors that come into it, what are the constituencies that make it what it is, how that could change, what are the kind of constituencies that maybe we can mobilize to change U.S. foreign policy, and mainly how U.S. foreign policy is affecting conflict-ridden areas overseas. So how is U.S. policy affecting the conflict in Syria or in Afghanistan or in Iraq or in Colombia or elsewhere? And that's what we want to get is a firmer grasp of how policy is made, what impact it has, and how we could change it. And I think today, as I said, it's more urgent given the changes that have taken place with Donald Trump's election. But it was true certainly at the time of the Iraq War. I think we probably then should have done much more in trying to decipher why these decisions were made and how they could be unmade.
The Trump administration is at odds, I think, with a lot of the policies that you guys advocate for at Crisis Group. How has that worked out for you so far? I mean, when you're reaching out to politicians and government officials in D.C. and specifically within the administration, have they been receptive?
So first of all, we try our best to be nonpartisan. It doesn't mean that we're not critical, right? I mean, during the Obama administration, I was in the administration, but Crisis Group still existed and criticized Obama policies, including those that I was in charge of. So we really try to be as objective and nonpartisan as possible. Right now, you're right. We have a number of areas of differences with this administration, from its the fact that it's withdrawn from some multilateral obligations and treaties, from trade to climate change to the Iran nuclear deal, possibly. It's focused on a militarized foreign policy, quite at odds with what Donald Trump himself as a candidate was campaigning for. Devaluation of certain historic values, human rights, et cetera. So there's a lot that we disagree with, and we're afraid that this administration is heading down the wrong path. But we try to be as constructive as possible. We're not in the invective or ad hominem attacks. And we still meet with members of the administration. I think the reason they still meet with us is because they find our analysis interesting. They find the context that we have unique. It doesn't mean they agree with what we say, although some members of the administration certainly do. They may be outvoted when it comes to decision time. But I think we are finding that we still have access. People, they want to influence us, and I think they are interested in our insights. That's not true of everyone, certainly, but of enough people that I still think we have an important role to play.
But even if you do want to have an influence on the administration, my question is, who do you talk to? I mean, we keep hearing about career diplomats, this great exodus from the State Department, and the lethargy and lack of leadership at the State Department. Who do you go to?
So the last thing I want to do is give any credence to this notion of a deep state, which
I'm sure you've spoken about on this program.
But it is true that for most issues, like the big ticket items, like what we're going to do on Syria, what we're going to do vis-a-vis Russia, that's decided at the most senior levels. Fair enough. And those people may not always want to talk to us, although even they sometimes do. But most policy about, say, Africa or conflict in Asia that wouldn't come to President Trump's desk or probably even to the National Security Advisor's desk on a daily basis, those are civil servants, foreign service officials, people at the CIA, people at the Pentagon, who I've worked with for years now. They worked under Presidents Clinton, Bush, Obama, and now Trump. So there's no, they don't have an ideological bone in their body. And those people want to listen to us. And those people actually can have a lot of influence on day-to-day policy, on issues that don't rise to that level that I was describing earlier. So we still have a lot of people we could talk to. They are very loyal. They're not, again, I want to make the point, they're not trying to undermine
the
Trump administration's policies. But on issues that President Trump doesn't have a strong view on, probably won't even look at in the foreseeable future, there's a lot that one can do. We give the best advice that we think we can, and then it's up to them to use it. And on some cases, in fact, we've been in agreement with the Trump administration. I'll take an example. Sudan, there was a debate about whether to lift some of the sanctions.
Right.
Our experts felt, and they lived in Sudan for, you know, they have access to Sudan, and their feeling was, now's the right time not to lift everything, not to give them carte blanche, but to show that engagement pays off and that if they do certain things, there'll be some reward. There was a debate within the administration, mirroring the debate, you know, at large in public opinion. In the end, we argued, as I say, for lifting some of those sanctions. That's what the administration did. So, and I know because I know it, but I've been told that members of the administration made use of what we of our arguments in their internal debates.
Interesting. Okay, so you know, I keep hearing about all this turnover within the State Department.
And there
are still faces you recognize there, and you can do business with.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, with President Trump seemingly pulling away from the world stage and pursuing a more nationalist agenda, I've heard you say that it presents a real opportunity for Europe to step in and assume a greater leadership role. My question is, with so many issues from Brexit to the refugee crisis to deal with, does there seem to be much of a desire for Europe to play a bigger external role? And if so, who takes the lead in that?
So it's a great question. I mean, so let me start with where I started from, which is I lived a long time, part of my life in Europe.
Right.
And I've heard from Europeans over and over again, particularly when I was in the administration, complaints about how the U.S. tries to monopolize areas of foreign policy, shoves other people aside, wants Europe to pay but not play. So my rejoinder to Europe now is, okay, that was your complaint. Now you have an opportunity with the U.S. not playing an active role in trying to resolve conflict, de-escalate conflicts, reach out to some countries on areas that are not simply counterterrorism. Do it. Now's your opportunity to do it. Now, the flip side, you're right that this unfortunately occurs at a time. So this period where the U.S. is playing less of a role as a forger of peace and conflict resolver coincides with the time where Europe itself is faced with all the problems you just mentioned. Germany in the middle of a coalition, you know, debate that could go on for some time, Brexit, the rise of populism within Europe itself. So it's unfortunate that the time when they could play a role, they're not best equipped to do it. But the European Union still stands. It still has a foreign policy. The French president seems to be quite active. The German coalition will at some point find its way. So there are still things that they can do. They can salvage the Iran nuclear deal. Let's start with that. Wouldn't it be a minor accomplishment? So you're right, but I still think there's a lot for Europe to do, and this is a moment for them to prove that they mean it when they say they want to play a bigger role.
And you alluded to your own personal history with Europe. You come from a very interesting background that almost seems to have predestined you for the path that you've chosen and to be
perfectly positioned to be president of the crisis group. Talk a little about your parents and growing up.
So the way I like to put it, I was born from a contradiction in some ways. I mean, so my father was, he's passed away, but he was a Egyptian Jew Arab nationalist. And that's a mouthful, but that's what he was.
I think that's what a lot of people would call a self-loathing Jew, probably.
But he wasn't, he wasn't self-loathing Jew, but he okay. was an Arab nationalist who then emigrated to the United States and became a very outspoken critic of American foreign policy. Then he moved to France, and he was such a critic of French foreign policy that they expelled him from France. So he basically always was a contrarian, living his own contradictions. And I didn't inherit all his views, but I inherited this desire to put myself in different people's shoes, which, of course, you know, as an Egyptian Jew, Arab nationalist, living in America, anti-American, living in France, anti-French, I got that sort of that seventh or that sixth sense of trying to figure out, okay, how does it look like if I were an Israeli or a Palestinian or an Iranian or whoever that is? And I found it's useful when you negotiate. I mean, in the Clinton administration, I was involved in Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Then under the Obama administration, I was I helped with the Iran negotiations. And in each case, it doesn't mean that you take the side of your opponent. You know, God forbid, that's not what we do. But we understand where I try to understand where they're coming from, which, as you say, is what we do at Crisis Group. Try to understand where they're coming from, which helps me then try to both address their concerns if it's perfectly compatible with our interests, U.S. interests, when I was negotiating for the U.S. Try to understand what matters to them, what doesn't matter to them, and how we can then forge a solution that meets all of our interests, but also meets them halfway.
And as someone who has been very experienced at negotiating various policies like the Iran deal and Camp David summit, I have to think that your unique ability to kind of put yourself in the position of the other person perhaps in some sense prevents you from falling into the trap of just seeing everything as a zero-sum game, which seems to always happen.
And one caveat is that, unfortunately, on the Palestinian-Israeli-Syrian, we failed to reach an agreement. So even that experience is not enough. But you're right. I think that's exactly, not look at it as a zero-sum game, not do sort of mirror imaging, which is to always assume that the way we look at the world is the way our opponent or our negotiating partner looks at the world. I mean, that's a danger that you see happen all the time, where people dismiss concerns that the other side raises because you think that you would dismiss them yourself. They may look at the world differently. They have their own history, their own culture, their own baggage. I mean, in the case of Iran, a long history of feeling, rightly or wrongly, that we've been after them since the coup against Prime Minister Mossadegh. So in all these cases, trying to understand why they feel as strongly as they do, and again, doesn't mean that you surrender to their demands, but it means that you understand where they're coming from. And I think it helps, it should help in negotiations. As I say, I haven't been successful in as many cases as I wish I had been.
Well, let's talk about that then, since we brought up the 2000 Camp David summit. You were part of the negotiating team under President Clinton. In the years since, credit for the failure of those negotiations has usually been placed squarely on the shoulders of Yasser Arafat. Do you think that postmortem is fair?
So about a year after the Camp David summit, which was, it was traumatic for all of us because we really thought there was a chance and it collapsed. And right after its collapse, everyone was pointing fingers at the Palestinians. I wrote an article with a colleague of mine, Hussein Aga, in which we tried to really look exactly at what had happened. And our conclusion, which was heretical at the time, was sure, Arafat had his share of responsibility and not a small one, but so too did the Israeli prime minister and so too did the American team. And we could get into it, but all three made huge tactical, perhaps strategic mistakes, and all three are responsible for the failure. I have to say now, some 18 years later, the unorthodoxy has become orthodoxy. I mean, if you read accounts today by people at Camp David, very few will say it's all Arafat's fault. They might put more of the blame on him than on others, but they almost all the memoirs that have been written since are not echoing our view. Everyone has a different view, but they do make the point that everyone was to blame. Israeli Prime Minister was this brilliant strategist, Ehud Barak.
Yeah.
He made the classic mistake that I just mentioned of mirror imaging. He thought he knew how his opponents thought without knowing them. And the way I analogized it to was he played chess with his opponent, but he really was playing with himself. Mm-hmm. And when his opponent didn't make the move that he expected him to make, he got upset. Mm-hmm. That somehow was a betrayal. So, you know, if the pawn was not moved in the you know, whatever move it should have been, then he cried foul, yeah. Not understanding that simply because they didn't follow his script didn't mean that they weren't following a rational one. And that's my main critique of the Israeli prime minister. He wanted to control everything, and he felt that he knew mm-hmm. what was the Palestinians' interests better than they did.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Robert Malley when we come back in just a minute. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you run your business from your cell phone while keeping your business and personal lives separate. Choose from their huge inventory of local, toll-free, and vanity toll-free numbers. Simply forward your new number to your mobile phone and start taking calls immediately. Whether you're in an office, in your car, or out shopping, Grasshopper's iPhone and Android apps help you stay connected to your customers. Not to mention, you can send and receive calls and texts from your business phone number, set up multiple extensions for everyone on your team, get your voicemails transcribed and emailed to you, work from anywhere with call forwarding, make and receive calls from your computer via the desktop app, and even utilize Wi-Fi calling. Better yet, Grasshopper offers easy and instant setup and 24/7 customer support, all without any long-term contracts. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. Support for today's show comes from Squarespace. Ready to start your new business? Make it stand out with Squarespace. Maybe you're revving up to launch a new company or spending the weekends working on a passion project. Well, these days, web presence is everything, and having a stylish, professional website is essential. Folks, I see it all the time. People put their hours and dollars into a new business, and they treat the website as an afterthought. That should be the first thing you do. With beautiful templates created by world-class designers, Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website. Showcase your work, blog or publish content, even sell products and services of all kinds in just a few clicks. You can customize everything from look and feel to settings and products, and it's all optimized for mobile right out of the box. Use Squarespace's analytics to help you grow in real time. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. Though if you do have a question, Squarespace's award-winning 24/7 customer support is there to help. Destiny is calling. It says you need a website. Make it with Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code KICK to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com, offer code KICK. Looking to move to the cloud? Don't know where to begin? Check out the Google Cloud Platform weekly podcast, where Google developer advocates Melanie Warrick and Mark Mandel answer questions, get in the weeds, and talk to GCP teams, customers, and partners about best practices. From security to machine learning and more, hear from technologists all across Google about trends and cool things happening with our technology. Click to learn more and subscribe to the podcast at g.co/GCP podcast. Again, that's g.co/GCP podcast. And now, back to the show. And last month, the Crisis Group put out an annual list of 10 conflicts to watch. Right. You say in this report that if you had written it a month later, you probably would have included the Israeli-Palestinian issue in that list for 2018. Things seem to have quieted down since Trump announced the plans to move the embassy to Jerusalem. In substance, has that been less of a bombshell than it seemed at the time?
Yes, to some extent, not entirely. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing that I don't know what I was anticipating. I don't think that I was anticipating great upheaval. It just is one more in a long process that is going to contribute to the disillusionment, disenchantment of the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. They're giving up on the two-state solution. They're giving up on nonviolence. They're giving up on the United States. And all that is harmful. Now, it's not too late, and the Trump administration is making renewed noises now that it wants to put a plan on the table, and that plan is going to be surprisingly fair. Let's wait and see. I mean, I think it's unfortunate that they really undermined their credibility with a series of moves. One was the announcement about Jerusalem. The other one is the cutback in assistance to the UN agency that provides help to the Palestinian refugees. So there have been a number of things that are just going to make the reception of the American plan, whenever it comes, mm-hmm. more negative than probably it needed to be. Although, again, I haven't seen the plan and I don't expect it to be fair, but you know,
I was going to ask.
I live to be surprised.
When you say surprisingly fair, is that your estimation, or is that what he's saying?
So I think what they're saying is,
or is he's probably saying hugely fair.
Yes, I don't want him, but
the fairest agreement ever.
Ever, indeed. I'm sure that's what he will say. I doubt that that's the case. I think their measure of what's fair it would differ considerably from mine or from many others. But anyway, in my business, I need to reserve judgment and wait to see what it is. I think they haven't yet given any evidence that they understand Palestinian concerns and preoccupations. But, you know, let's see what they come up with. This list of 10 conflicts, I mean, it's always a sort of an internal fight. You know, who's going to make that list? It's unfortunate. I'm waiting for the day where we're going to struggle to get to 5.
Yeah.
Now we can get to 20 or 30 in no time. Israel-Palestinian conflict probably can make it every year, but to be fair, I mean, I had added that we could have added it, but truth is, the number of deaths that are caused by that conflict pale in comparison to the number of deaths that happen on a daily basis in Syria or in Yemen or in Afghanistan. So it probably was right not to include it on the list. It just was my irritation at the announcement and my, you know, kind of anger at the announcement about Jerusalem because it was gratuitous. It was purely motivated by domestic considerations. It didn't advance the ball. And it could have been done in a way that was much smarter and would not have caused as much anger as it did on the Palestinian and Arab side.
I want to get your opinion on something. For a long time, my personal impression has been that the push for a two-state solution has always been coming from the outside. And there's very little actual belief or motivation for a two-state solution in Israel and Palestine. Is that actually the case?
I mean, I wrote a piece once that basically said that the only true believers in the two-state solution are those on the outside who are pushing for it. Very hard to find Israelis or Palestinians. That's a little bit of an overstatement, but it is true that in terms of the energy for a two-state solution, it's been much greater in Europe and sometimes here than it's been on the ground. I just came back from a trip to Israel and the occupied territories in December with my family, kind of a vacation, if you will. I don't know that we spoke to a single Palestinian under the age of 30 who has any patience for the two-state solution. Mm. They moved on. They have this view of a one-state solution, which I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's unrealistic. I don't think that Israeli Jews are prepared to contemplate such an outcome. But it does say something that they just don't have any – it doesn't resonate with them. This two-state solution doesn't resonate. They just don't believe it in anymore. If you travel around the West Bank, you see what the ground looks like, and it's very hard to imagine that there could be a partition that's going to make sense, that's going to give rise to viable – contiguous Palestinian state. So I understand that, but you're absolutely right that the first ones to stop believing in it were the ones who are most concerned, and the last ones who'll stop believing in it are the ones on the outside who are pouring money to try to keep the illusion maybe or the myth alive. I've not given up on the two-state solution, but I must say every day that goes by it becomes harder to believe in it.
Well, the question is, what's the alternative?
And that's the point. The alternative is a status quo, which is the most sustainable of all outcomes, unfortunately. But even that status quo, at some point, if we continue, it will blow up. And so the alternative could be violence and bloodshed, which is obviously not a solution. But, you know, Israelis and Palestinians now have lived for some time in this intermediate zone between a one-state reality and a two-state aspiration. And that could go on, and that's not good for anyone.
Well, I want to talk more about the conflicts that did make it on the list. And before we get into that, you open the report by saying the first words out of your mouth are, not everything is about Trump. What do you mean by that in the context of this?
Because, you know, it's true that a lot of the trends that we're looking at, which is greater militarization, greater focus, militarization of foreign policies, not just the U.S., but of global foreign policies, greater emphasis on the war against terrorism and counterterrorism, less multilateralism, more populism. Those may have been intensified with Trump, but they preceded him. You know, less interest in or less success in conflict resolution. So again, our point is this is not just about one man. And by the end of the piece, we say inevitably it also is about Trump because he has made some things much worse. But he is as much an expression as he is the instigator of some of these trends. And I think that's what we're trying to say, that what you're, what we're seeing around the world, which is greater resort to conflict and to war, means of war that had been prescribed, whether it's use of chemical weapons or the ethnic cleansing that took place in Myanmar. Those are things. So it's not just more resort to war and an erosion of norms against warfare, but then erosions of the norms about how you conduct warfare. And those, again, I would not attribute to President Trump, although, again, he is unfortunately aggravating those trends. So that's our point. Let's not simply think it's one man and once he's gone, everything will be fine. Things had been going downhill before him.
Well, one area where President Trump does have a lot of influence, for better or worse, is the number one problem listed on this list, which is North Korea. Now, when you published this list a little over a month ago, it was at the height of the escalating rhetoric between Trump and Kim Jong-un. Trump was saying that there was no diplomatic solution, but now the tension seems to have de-escalated some. North and South Korea are at least open to dialogue. How optimistic are you at this point? If you publish the list today, would it still make number one?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the reason we put it number one even then was not because we thought it had the highest risk of occurring. Mm-hmm. It was that if it were to occur, it would be by far the greatest disaster, the greatest calamity since the Second World War. So this was a combination of probably low probability, very high risk. That probability goes up and down every day. I mean, if you speak to members of the administration, which I do on this issue, they are certainly projecting a feeling that they're not prepared to compromise, that North Korea is going to have to take steps towards denuclearization, or there's going to be only one way left. And the implication is that it's a military way. Now, when I hear that, I always think to myself, part of it is that if this is a bluff, they have to bluff to everyone, myself included. I mean, if they start showing cracks and to some people, they say, well, we're not really serious about it, but we're saying it in order to convince the North Koreans. They know this is going to trickle down to the North Koreans, to the Chinese, and to others who they want to convince that they're serious about taking military action. So part of it could be a bluff game.
I mean, is that a wise strategy? I'll tell you, a month ago I had George Shultz on. He said Reagan would tell everyone in his administration, never bluff. Never bluff unless you're willing to follow through, because if you get called on your bluff, you have no options left.
That's right.
You're backed into a corner.
That's right. That is a danger. Particularly, I mean, the other danger is it's not clear that the other side knows if you're bluffing, if you're not bluffing.
Right.
And sometimes in the case of Kim Jong-un, a opponent or who we don't know that well, I mean, no foreign leader has met him, he may
Dennis
be reading.
Rodman doesn't count?
Leader, maybe a basketball leader. How is he going to read if he's convinced that President Trump does want to strike and then he sees a military maneuver and he says, aha, this is the first step towards a strike. I need to do something preemptively in order to save myself. Mm-hmm. So you're playing with fire, where in this case the fire would be so devastating that, again, our recommendation is take a pause. Pause the situation now. Try to freeze it as much as you can. Without doing anything that would be detrimental to U.S. interests, and start talking.
And number two on the list is the U.S.-Saudi-Iran rivalry. President Trump certainly seems to be aligning himself more closely with the Saudis at a time of unusual instability in that country. What concerns you most about that?
So it's not so much instability in Saudi Arabia. It's more the region as a whole has now sort of in the vortex of three conflicts. One is between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and we see that manifested in Yemen. We see it manifested in the Gulf. We see it manifested to some extent in Syria. We see it manifested in Lebanon. Another one is the Iran-Israel confrontation, which we just saw a manifestation of in over the skies of Syria, but it can be expressed in Lebanon and elsewhere as well. And the third is the Iran-U.S. confrontation, which itself is manifested in Iraq, in Syria, in the battle over the nuclear deal. And so the problem with all three of these is that what could be sparked in one place could quickly light a fire elsewhere. So what happens in Yemen could quickly spill over into Iran, into Iraq, into Syria, into Lebanon, into Israel. So this is really the kind of wildfire that we are afraid of. And you combine that with the fact that those three pairings that I mentioned, Israel-Iran, Saudi Arabia-Iran, U.S.-Iran, in no case is there any high-level discussion. In some cases, there's no diplomacy at all. There's no high-level contact between the U.S. and Iran. Something that really is a change from the Obama administration. There's no serious discussion between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and there's no contact whatsoever between Israel and Iran. So when you combine a high risk of escalation, zero diplomacy, that's why we put it number two on the list.
And you played a major role in negotiating the Iran nuclear deal. I confess that at the time, I was somewhat skeptical initially. But
you should have called me.
By all accounts, including many in the Trump administration, it seems to be working, keeping Iran's nuclear ambitions in check. Despite that, Trump still talks a tough talk about decertifying the deal or making additional demands on Iran. Do you think that the pragmatist in him, to the extent that there is one, may keep him from making any kind of moves that might jeopardize the deal?
I don't know. Yeah. I'm at a 50-50 point at this stage. I think he's made clear. I mean, you know, if you try to decipher the or try to understand the motivations for President Trump's behavior, yeah, we'd be at it for many hours. I think part of it is he's driven by a conviction that he wants to show that he's living up to the commitments he's made during the campaign, mm-hmm, in one form or another. And he wants to be defined as the non-Obama, the un-Obama. In this case, when Iran, that does bring you to the point where he wants to either undo the deal or show that he has improved it, that he's made it better.
Right. Okay.
Now, it's not possible really to make it better. You're not going to renegotiate. Certainly not going to renegotiate unilaterally. But he's opened – he's given one chance. He wants the Europeans and Congress to give him enough, mm-hmm, for him to come out and say, you see, I strengthened at least our interpretation, our way of dealing with this agreement. Is that going to be enough? Are the Europeans and Congress – is there a way – and this is a question we ask in what we've written – is there a way to give him symbolically a victory but not do anything that changes the terms of the nuclear deal? Because if you change the terms of the nuclear deal, Iran will claim correctly that it's a violation. Mm-hmm. It is a very, very, very narrow window there. And that's why I say that I'm at the 50-50 range. Maybe you could find a way, but I would not at all be shocked if President Trump announced, and he said he could do it as early as May 12th, we tried, we failed. This is the worst agreement ever negotiated, is what he said. Even though, as you just pointed out, his own State Department has itself said that Iran is respecting the deal over and over again.
Right, and Mattis as well.
Everyone, I mean, there's nobody with a straight face can say that Iran is violating the deal. But I would not be shocked if he decided on May 12th, you know what? I said it's the worst deal ever negotiated. I live by my word. I said it on Jerusalem. I said it on NAFTA. I said it on TPP. I said it on the Paris Climate Change Accord. And that would play well with his base, mm-hmm, which of course is the overriding or overwhelming factor in his consideration. So that's why I'm worried. And what we've done at Crisis Group is, number one, try to provide all the arguments as to why that would be a very bad outcome. But number two, talking to Europeans in particular, bringing back to that point, telling them there's a way perhaps, and talking to the Iranians, there's a way to preserve the deal even if the U.S. walks away.
And another one that probably not surprisingly made the list is Syria. You served as President Obama's ISIS czar. ISIS seems to have largely been defeated militarily. What comes next? Do they just vanish into the sunset? Do they regroup or transform into something different? What's their next move?
So I think the question raises two points. First, I mean, ISIS, and this is why it was such a complex phenomenon, it was sort of four movements in one. It was a quasi-like state, caliphate. It was an insurgency. It was a terrorist organization. And it was an inspirer of others who resorted to terrorism with very, mm-hmm, loose links to the mother organization. What we're seeing now is basically, and we had always expected that it would take about 3 years to get to that point, and we're about the three-year mark, is the defeat of the first dimension, the caliphate, the state-like structure. That's the one that was their weakest point, because it's very hard to hold territory when you're confronted by, you know, air force and troops on the ground by the United States or by, mm-hmm, Iraq or the coalition. What's remaining are the other three, is their insurgency, which they could always regroup as and start fighting back areas that are being retaken from them, terrorism, which is very cheap for them to undertake, and the inspiration. And so the focus is going to have to turn to those three. But the other point is that the defeat of ISIS, and this is something that I remember raising in meetings with the president and others, once people were less fearful of ISIS, they're, mm-hmm, quickly going to turn, and even before ISIS is defeated, to what they really care about. And that is political issues, issues of power, issues of control among them. So it's Turkey and the Kurds. It's Shia-Sunni battles in Iraq. It's the battle for Syria post-ISIS. And what we're seeing now throughout the region is the surfacing of all these other conflicts that had been put more or less in brackets during the fight against ISIS, mm-hmm, never fully ignored, but sort of put on the back burner. They're all coming back with a vengeance. Yeah. And that's what we've seen recently, particularly in Syria, which has become the arena in which everyone wants to fight his or her favorite fight.
But let's suppose that ISIS is defeated to the extent that it can be, and the Assad regime is then able to focus all of its attention on its other rivals in the country. And eventually, the Assad regime is the only party left standing. Do you consider that a good outcome?
No, it's not a good outcome. I don't think we're going to get to the point, certainly in the foreseeable future, and certainly with President Assad at the helm, where Syria will be stabilized. I think it will be, you know, he is making gains. And at this point, the notion that he's going to be toppled or overthrown is probably illusory. But the country is fragmented. It is, as I said, the arena now. I mean, it is quite an extraordinary, if you look at it, a country that tried to pride itself on as being the beating heart of Arab nationalism. You now have Turkish troops, you have an Iranian presence, you have a U.S. presence, you have the Kurds that have a quasi-autonomous area, you have Israel that on a weekly basis or monthly basis engages in air raids. So it's lost its sovereignty, it's lost its central unity. So that is gone. Has he won the war that he cared about? So far, yes. He's won the war against the opposition that was trying to topple him. And again, we could spend hours about why that happened and what mistakes were made by everyone to get to the point where so many Syrians died and President Assad is still in power.
A lot of the problem areas that we're talking about are the ones that are on people's radar. Among the other of the 10 conflicts on this list, which are the ones that maybe aren't getting enough attention in the media, perhaps overlooked?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is Yemen. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not to stick only to the Middle East region, but it is one where you've seen, 8 million people on the brink of famine, a million cases or so of cholera, 3 million people displaced. This was the poorest country before the war. Imagine what it's like now. And the reason why I say it is, and living here in the United States, is we have a lot of leverage. And this is a criticism that's not only directed at the Trump administration. The Obama administration didn't succeed either. But we are a very, very close partner of Saudi Arabia, which is a leader of the coalition that is fighting in Yemen. So we have leverage to try to broker a political settlement, and we need to do much more to get there, to respect the humanitarian rights, which are being violated both by the Saudi-led coalition and, of course, by the Houthi rebels. So something needs to be done there, and that's why we put it high up on the list. Because I'm speaking here in the U.S., I might have chosen a different one if I was speaking elsewhere. Afghanistan, I mean, it's sort of receded from my memory. It's the longest war in America's history. We're now at a new stage where we're saying victory is upon us because we're going to increase the military, our military muscle. And I have to say, that's just, you know, I don't know how we could buy that used car again. Don't we have to conclude at some point that even when we had 100,000 troops and the Taliban were weaker, we didn't prevail? So now we have a tenth of that, roughly. The Taliban are stronger. They control, you know, vast areas of the country. Isn't it time to say, okay, we don't mean we're going to withdraw precipitously, but let's put more effort on the diplomatic track. Mm-hmm. Let's talk to the Taliban. I mean, that's that. It just seems like we could be at this another 10 years. And no president likes to say, oh, well, maybe the military road is not going to lead to victory, so let's pivot, because it's an admission of defeat, and the U.S. doesn't like doing that. Well, but for those of you who haven't yet seen the documentary that Ken Burns did on Vietnam, which I suspect you have watched.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I had him on the show. He was
okay,
great.
Well, you know, I just watched it not long ago, and every case is sui generis. But I don't think that a serious thinker about American foreign policy can still consider him or herself serious and not watch it, because it has lessons about how one stumbles into war and how difficult it is to get out of it.
Well, I want to try as best I can to end on a hopeful note here.
I want to see that.
Are there conflicts that maybe made the list last year but improved to the point that they didn't make it on the list in 2018? And what happened there? Or is it not necessarily a case that the crisis got better, but simply that much worse crises have emerged over the past year?
So, I mean, there always are changes. As I say, we try not to repeat ourselves too much. If I want to end on a note of optimism, I mean, there always are successes. Maybe the successes are far less than the failures. But you have the Colombia Peace Agreement, which is, you know, it's not solid, but we believe strongly that it needs to be supported. We have the Iran nuclear deal, which averted a conflict, which was, you know, if you remember in 2014, the Israeli prime minister was saying we'd go to war if Iran continued with its enrichment program. Yeah. The Obama administration was preparing war plans. So that is a success. You know, North Korea, I'm not saying, I don't want to be optimistic, But there's a chance. There's a real chance, we think, of trying to capitalize on what's happened now with the Olympic Games to try to pivot from the belligerent and bellicose tone to something that's more diplomatic. So there always is, there always are opportunities. I mean, let's not forget, conflicts are made by men and women, much more often by men than by women, and they can be resolved by men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the mandate of our organization. There's not a, there's no conflict that is either, every conflict can either be resolved or its worst impacts can be mitigated. And that's what we're fighting for. And we think that there's always room for hope.
Mm-hmm.
And there always are small victories, even even amidst a pretty somber picture.
Before we go, I read somewhere that your wife, who you met when you were, I think, in law school at Harvard, clerked for, I think, Sandra Day O'Connor, and you clerked for Supreme Court Justice Byron White. Is there maybe some message there as far as the value of peace and diplomacy? I assume you're still together.
We're definitely together.
Okay.
I just say she works on healthcare. So when we come out, come back home from a day of work, and I'm bemoaning the possible collapse of the Iran nuclear deal, which I spent 2 years negotiating, and she's looking at the possible undoing of Obamacare, which she has been working on. It makes for some unpleasant dinner conversations.
Yeah.
But yes, so we keep at it.
There's hope in that, at least, I guess. Well, where can people learn more about the International Crisis Group?
Our website is www.crisisgroup.org. And I would say everything we do is public. I mean, we consider our job to be a public good, so it's not for sale. Of course, we welcome support by folks who believe in our mission and who want to help us, that we'd be more than happy to talk to them. But what we do because we believe in it. And so just get on our website and you'll see everything we write about.
Excellent work. Well, Robert Malley, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks again to Robert Malley for coming on the podcast. To learn more about the International Crisis Group, visit crisisgroup.org. And follow Robert Malley and ICG on Twitter at @Rob_Malley and @Crisis Group. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.